Hello, and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Baumgarten, the managing editor at Crosscut. There's a lot at stake in the 2020 presidential election, especially for Democrats. And in Washington state, 2020 marks a big change for the party. Instead of relying on caucuses to weigh in on the primary race, the party voted last year to switch to a primary election. That primary is being held on March 10th, which means that Washington Democrats could have a real impact on a race that's still far from over. Less than 2 weeks before ballots are counted, Crosscut gathered political leaders and researchers to discuss the issues and debate the merits of the remaining Democratic candidates. First up, Crosscut staff reporter Melissa Santos and I brought Stuart Elway to the stage to discuss the results of the recent Crosscut Elway poll of likely primary voters. Elway has been analyzing public opinion since 1975. Then, for part two, we invited three more political minds to weigh in on the race: Tina Podlodowski, Crystal Fincher, and Mark Allen Smith. You'll hear more about these three during the episode. This conversation is sponsored by Alaska Airlines. It was recorded at the KCTS9 studios on February 27, 2020, as part of the Crosscut Talks Live series. Welcome to Crosscut Talks, Stuart.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So the latest Crosscut Elway poll, which was fielded earlier this month, found that many Democratic voters are still undecided about the Democratic primary election. Bernie Sanders was the top choice among those who knew who they're voting for, with Michael Bloomberg coming in second and Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar tied for third. To my left here is Crosscut political reporter Melissa Santos. She's been busy covering the primary for us in the last couple months. Melissa, so before we get to Stuart in the poll, tell us why the primary is different this year and what does it mean for voters in the state? Oh, yeah, applaud for Melissa. I'm sorry. I take her for granted. I really take her for granted.
It's all right.
Sorry.
Well, this primary is way earlier. I don't know if you all probably have ballots in the mail, you know, at this point. March 10th, way earlier than we've had a vote by mail primary. The last time it was May 24th, which is huge. That's light years in presidential politics time, right? So March 10th is a week after Super Tuesday, when a lot of states do their nominating contests. So theoretically, candidates can still be in the race then. We only had Bernie and Hillary Clinton last time, so many fewer, even though it wasn't fully locked up quite then. And you know, this is just a really much earlier chance for voters in Washington to weigh in. Democrats are also using the primary this year, which is totally different. They used to use these caucuses, where it were meetings at libraries, and I've been to some auditoriums, like gymnasiums, that, you know, were just a completely different system where you generally went in person to cast your vote, and rather than having a ballot mailed to you. So totally different system.
Okay. So Stuart, you conducted this poll,
yeah.
Which we see a very wee rendition of on this television screen. It's a little smaller than we thought it was going to be, but you can read but on the screen is the results. We see Bernie Sanders with 21%. Bloomberg with 15, and then Klobuchar and Warren tied with 11. What is the story that this poll has told you?
The story it told me is that this is still very fluid. We have all these candidates. There were several more that were on the Washington ballot. Many of whom have dropped out already. So in polling, back up one step. Polling in primary is fraught with challenges. It's all about turnout and timing. Who's going to turn out? Turnout's lower in these elections than they are in November, when it's much more predictable. And then the timing. We did this poll last week, which was before the Nevada debate, before the Nevada caucus. The South Carolina primary is coming next. Super Tuesday is coming, and then we're going to vote. And this poll was taken before all of that happened. So it's very fluid for that reason. But also, as we saw in the candidates, Bernie Sanders led with 21%. So you've got, we had 11, 12 candidates named in the poll, and the leader has 21%. The leading candidate has 79% of the people who support someone else, and they're the leader. So that indicates some of the fluidity of it. So each of the top six candidates, so it's Sanders 21, Bloomberg at 16, Warren, Klobuchar, Biden, and Buttigieg, Buttigieg was at 9. Everybody else is in double figures. So a number of things. Each of those candidates is within the margin of error of the candidate ahead of them. So that could totally switch by the time we vote. And Super Tuesday is going to cull this herd some more, maybe, maybe not. And then each of the top six candidates, we ask who's your second choice. Each of the top six candidates, their second choice was... Each of the other five candidates was named as a second choice for some of their supporters, including Bloomberg and Sanders had second choice. 14% of, I got to find it, 24% of Bloomberg supporters said Bernie Sanders was their second choice. So... fluid is the word I keep coming up with. It's not a fluid enough word.
So, Stuart, why do we spend all of the time and the resources and the energy to conduct a poll like this if the answer is that it's fluid?
Because I got a mortgage.
Oh, okay, right. All right.
Okay. Well, so you had mentioned that, you know, this was done, it was done before the Nevada debate. It was done before the South Carolina debate. And, you know, then also Bernie won those Nevada caucuses. How does that change things? How could it change things potentially?
Well, there are several things that probably would change this immediately, because this was, as I say, before that debate, that first debate where Bloomberg did so poorly. And so he shows up here in second place, leading all these candidates that have been in the field for a long time, and then he just bombs in that debate. So if we'd have done the poll, a week after that, we would see different results, we think. But the reason is, to answer your first question, Mark, is we want to see the dynamics of the race. And we all get locked in to the horse race, who's ahead, who's not. But this is a very dynamic process that's really just started. There haven't even been a million votes cast yet. So it's going to be a churning sort of thing for a while, and we want to see how it's playing in Washington. And our poll really mirrored a lot of what we're seeing nationally. Bernie won the Nevada caucuses, but he didn't get a majority of the vote. He didn't win the Iowa caucuses. We'll see what happens in South Carolina. All this is still... churning, and the idea, the story is, I think, there's a couple things that struck me sort of going into and coming out of this poll, for Democrats particularly, the feeling that the stakes are so high that we can't screw it up. And I think between that factor and the number of candidates has... almost, you might, a paralyzing effect on Democrats. They're so afraid to make a mistake that, Bloomberg looks pretty good now, and then, oh, no, we had a bad debate. Klobuchar looks good now. I think I have this sense that Democrats are still shopping. Even the Bernie bros, the Bernie supporters, he still has a core, but it's smaller than last time. He's not getting in a 12-person race. He doesn't get the same vote he gets in a 2-person race.
So, So we have, you know, this poll was of 404 voters.
Right.
How is that sort of enough to kind of get all this from the field? I mean, how is that enough to gauge voter sentiment? Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, we started with a list of registered voters. We looked at likely Democrats, households. We pulled from that, and then we asked people if they're going to vote in the Democratic primary. Definitely, probably not, or I may not vote. We took the probablys and the definitelys. And then we asked them a second question, which I'll read it to you. In order for your ballot to be counted, you must check the box on the return envelope declaring that your party preference is the Democratic Party. That declaration becomes public record. Given that, will you say you will, and then probably, definitely, probably not vote? And 80% then said they would probably vote. So of those who said they'd initially would vote, 20% were less than definite when they heard about the party declaration. So we have a random sample of 404 people who are likely or probably self-reported going to vote in this primary. That's given the probability theory, that gives us the margin of error you always hear about, of plus or minus 5% of the number we would get if we had talked to every Democrat who said they're going to vote in this primary. So it's sampling theory.
So you know, polls. People don't always feel like the polls in 2016 really represented the outcome.
We actually have a question from the audience here that said, didn't we learn in 2016 race that polls mean nothing? At best, semi-representative, at worst, misinformation?
Yeah, a lot of people feel they were kind of duped by those 2016 polls. So, I mean, you know, how should we read the polls from this year in light of what happened in 2016 with polling?
I gotta go.
Okay, journalists well, also didn't, you yeah, know, no, you know, well, no. We got bad
okay,
rap too.
I'm going to blame the journalists.
Oh. All right.
Because the national polls actually were right. The national polls predicted a 3% Clinton win, and she won by 2.5%. The national polls were as accurate as they'd ever been.
For the popular vote.
For the popular yeah. vote. Well, as we know, the race for the presidency is not a national election. It's 50 statewide elections. So in those key states, the polling wasn't as robust as it might have been. But what happened, we've got these aggregators now, Nate Silver, Real Clear Politics, that aggregate these polls, and they allocate a chance that someone's going to win. And they based on all these polls. Nate Silver said that Trump actually had a 30% chance to win. Now, 300 is a pretty good batting average. If you're kicking field goals and you know you could hit 3 out of 10. So it wasn't a slam dunk. Then some other of the predictors said much higher than that. But those journalists take that and say, she's going to win. Well, there was a 30% chance she wasn't going to win. And all the straws fell in the right direction. And as a matter of fact, he won by a total of about 70,000 votes in 10 counties. That's what made the difference last time. And so it's hard to, I know the polls will forever take the hit for that, but it's not entirely justified. So, and at this point, and we make it a point here at Crosscut not to do predictive election polls. We did this well ahead of the election on purpose, because there's no real purpose served by a poll coming out the day before the election to predict the election, because the voters are going to decide. What we want to do was see what the lay of the land was here, what the dynamic was. And I think we found that in this poll.
So, we're just giving you a hard time.
Yeah.
I mean, we do a lot of work here guided by you to try to present the context of these polls and to show people how to read them. But we really rely on you to kind of show us, to dig a little bit deeper into the numbers. And what I want to know, and I think what everybody in this room wants to know, is there anything in this poll that tells you what is going to happen with that 22% that shows you where the undecideds are going to go?
Yeah. Not really. I mean, we have here's the thing about that, this electorate. I guess if we're doing probability, probably the highest probability is that a fair number of those won't vote. They'll still be undecided and decide not to vote. Hmm. Because the numbers we had are higher. In 2016, the turnout in the primary was 35%. And I think the turnout in the Democratic side was about 20% of the whole electorate. So we've got more than that here. We've got, 65-70% telling us they're going to vote. Well, they aren't all going to vote. So that's going to be part of it.
Is it just because the field is so crowded? I mean, do you see similarities in the polling in this year's crowded Democratic primary and the polling in 2016?
No,
on the
I think so.
Side?
Yeah. In 2016, well, on the Democrat side, Clinton was well known, and Sanders had his supporters, and there was a binary choice, and so the undecided was lower. I think on the Republican side, I'd have to go back, but you probably see similar kind of thing happening here. And we're seeing, interestingly, the same thing happening here. And again, this is a place where our poll reflects the national events. You've got Sanders leading. There's already starting to be a conventional wisdom that he's inevitable, even though less than 1 million people have voted. So far, but there's this sense that no one's going to stop him. Da da da. Well, and we've seen this play before. This is the same thing that happened to the Republicans last time.
Who is the Bernie Sanders on the Republican side that was inevitable that didn't end up being the nominee?
Donald Trump. Last time there were 17 Republican candidates or some such number, and everyone stayed in. Everyone was afraid to take on Trump because they. We're afraid to offend his supporters. We're seeing the same dynamic on the Republican side this time. We've seen it here in Washington. It was when Gary Locke got elected governor. On the Republican side, there were 6 or 7 candidates, sort of 6 moderates, and Ellen Craswell. And the moderates stayed in the race. Nobody got out of each other's way. And Ellen Craswell got the Republican nomination. So it's a common pattern. And we're seeing it play out here. And so, until Super Tuesday maybe sorts this out some. And even then, beyond that, the Tina will be up here later. She can talk to this a lot more knowledge than I have. But it's looking more and more like a contested convention if all these – I keep pointing at my poll results here. All these people stay in the race. It seems very likely to me that no one gets there with a majority. And Sanders could possibly get there with having won a number of primaries and still be at 40% of the delegates he needs. And then – all the political scientists are going to have a heyday.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a little bit. The one thing I want to ask you before we usher you off the stage is...
Do a big round of applause.
Exactly. we're going to be conducting a poll for the general election. What do you think we're going to be trying to see in that poll?
Well, we'll be doing it, again, a couple of weeks before the election at least. We're going to be seeing how things are shaping up here. Let's just for fun assume Tim Iman and Jay Inslee are going to be running for governor. What impact is and we don't know who the Democratic nominee is going to be, but we aren't. I've made a living predicting Democrats to win in Washington State. I get good ratings by doing that. So we're going to be, I think we'll be looking at the other dynamics and some of the down ballot sort of races. Is this going to be a sweep? Is it all about Trump? Or, you know, if it's Bernie Sanders, are we embracing democratic socialism? All those things will be pretty clear by October when we do that poll.
So is there any scenario where the Democratic candidate has an effect down ballot that actually changes the chemistry in Washington and Tim Iman becomes
again,
our governor? Just want to know.
Yeah. Well, I think if let's imagine that Bernie Sanders is president and Tim Iman is governor. And ask Tina about that one when she comes up here.
All right. Stuart, thank you so much for coming out here and setting the table for us.
Glad
we're going to
be
out here with three very smart guests to kind of talk a little bit more about what's coming up. But let's give Stuart a round of applause. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Crosscut Talks is supported by Alaska Airlines. Alaska flies to over 115 destinations worldwide, with an average of 1,200 daily flights across the United States, Mexico, Canada, and Costa Rica. Every Alaska flight has high-speed Wi-Fi, free chat, free movies, a rotating seasonal menu, and the highest-rated customer experience of any North American airline. Alaska also tops the charts in environmental sustainability, having been ranked the most fuel-efficient U.S. airline for 7 years running. It's the highest-rated U.S. airline on the Dow Jones Sustainability Index, and it helps passengers offset the carbon impact of every trip they take. Learn more and book your next trip at alaskaair.com.
Welcome back to Crosscut Talks, and welcome to our panel of political minds. All right. So all the way on the left there, we have Tina Podlodowski. Tina is the chair of the Washington State Democrats, a role she's held since 2017. She previously served on the Seattle City Council and was a candidate in 2016 for Secretary of State, which is Washington's chief elections official. Thanks for coming to Crosscut Talks.
Thanks. Tina. Happy to be here.
Mark Allen Smith is a professor of political science at the University of Washington. His research looks at the intersection of politics, religion, and economics, and he's written multiple books touching on those topics, including Secular Faith, How Culture Has Trumped Religion in American Politics. Mark, thanks for coming on the show. And finally, we have Crystal Fincher here. Crystal is a political consultant currently working on statewide and local ballot initiatives, as well as voter engagement in underrepresented communities. She has years of experience in Washington politics, having worked in the past on congressional, statewide, and local races. Crystal, thanks for being here.
Well, so I want to start this off, and I want to talk about Bernie Sanders a little bit. So what does it mean, I'm going to start with you, Tina, if Bernie Sanders, who identifies as a democratic socialist, ends up the nominee for the Democratic Party? Just maybe take 2-3 minutes and tell us, what does that mean for the party in your view?
It means that we'll have a terrific candidate to beat Donald Trump. I mean, I think we have a whole set of great candidates to beat Donald Trump. But it's been clear as you've looked at this cycle that Bernie has motivated a great coalition of voters all the way through. It is still so early in the process. I mean, if you look at the first four states combined, the number of delegates that they actually award on the road to getting to 1,991 to get the nomination, I think it's a little less than the total number of delegates that Washington State awards when it's time for our presidential primary. So it's early. It's really, really early to do that. But I think that no matter who the presidential candidate is, we'll have an enthusiastic campaign. People will come together. This whole theme of unity around no matter who the candidate is has been something that Democrats have been thinking about and worried about and working on for the entire cycle. So whether it's Bernie, whether it's somebody else, I think we're just going to be relieved to have our candidate and to get together and go and beat Trump.
Mark, I'm curious. Greg, I'm curious what you see when you see, you know, well, I mean, the leader in our poll, besides the undecideds, was a Democratic Socialist. Is that a shift? Or what do you think that means for where the Democratic Party is going? Or can we tell at this point?
Well, he's running as a Democrat, and should he gain the nomination, I think he would quickly consolidate the party around him. Not unlike what happened with Trump on the Republican side in 2016, where he was a plurality winner throughout, but once he got the nomination, the party rallied around him. And we're in an age of intense polarization where it really is pick a side. And right now, there's a lot of dissension in the Democratic ranks of, you know, is Sanders the strongest candidate and what would happen? But, I mean, I think we're seeing the parties becoming very distinctive. And if he becomes a nominee, some of these people who are a little uncertain right now, they're going to quickly rally around him. And I think he has a very good chance to bring in a lot of new voters, especially young voters, which is the biggest pool of, you know, out there of non-voters. And he is the Democratic candidate who best appeals to younger voters. So I think he has the most possibility to bring new people into the system.
Crystal, what do you think about, you know, the Democratic Socialist is the Democratic nominee? What does that mean to you?
I think what a lot of people focus on is the label. But I think what's really illuminating is that if you take away the label and you look at the policies, they're incredibly popular. And so I think the focus that you'll see long term is really talking about the issues and not trying to get into, okay, this is just a socialist, a Democratic Socialist. I think Seattle is a great example of this conversation where we have people with a lot of different labels. But at the end of the day, most voters are looking at the policy to see, does this align with my values? Will this help my family? And the policies that he and the other candidates are talking about are popular with the Democratic base and beyond. You know, you look at something like, you know, free tuition or increasing the minimum wage, and those are policies that are passing in red states as statewide initiatives. And so the potential appeal that the nominee has is immense.
Well, so that kind of brings me to my next question, where it's like, are these attacks that are probably going to come? We heard Obama derided as a socialist when he wasn't even saying he was a Democratic Socialist. Different era, potentially now. But what are those attacks going to look like on Bernie being a socialist? And do you think they'll even be effective? I mean, do people care if people use the socialist boogeyman against someone with popular policies like that?
You know, I think we've seen some of these attacks before, and I think people are just kind of like, yeah, we know he's a socialist. He ran 4 years ago. We understand what he calls himself, but what has continued to draw people to him is the policy that he stands up for, and they see him and other candidates really standing up for their families in a way that maybe they haven't seen or felt from people in the past. And so I think that the attacks almost become, you know, like a fanciful caricature, and they just don't align with what people are actually seeing and hearing and feeling at home. So I think that, you know, kind of similarly, we saw a number of the attacks against Trump just kind of slide off of him in 2016. I think that we're actually seeing a similar effect with Bernie Sanders.
Mark, I mean, what attacks do you expect if Bernie is at the top of the ticket? If a Democratic Socialist, I think he's the only one, but who knows? Something weird could happen. What attacks do you expect, and do you think those would be effective?
I think there are endless possibilities for attacks, especially with the targeting possibilities that are available now. For example, use of texts going to people's cell phones. So I've gotten two messages so far. I'm not sure what list I'm on. Maybe Tina could tell me how my name got associated with particular candidates. But people are going to be barraged with information, and a lot of it is going to be extremely targeted and outside the range of the national media or the state media. And so I could easily see attacks. So Medicare for All polls pretty well. It doesn't poll as well among people who are actually on Medicare because they do have some concern. Maybe this is going to dilute this for me. I could easily see a lot of messages going to older voters that are saying, if Bernie gets elected, your own Medicare is in jeopardy. And that may not be like a national, you know, ad campaign, but you could easily target particular individuals with that kind of message. And then maybe others with, other kinds of attacks. And there are some parts of of Bernie's past, because he's been around for a few decades, and some, you know, bizarre love poetry and various things that have been kind of under the radar so far. But if he becomes the nominee, you will hear about those. And so it will be a lot of vicious attacks, I expect. And so the challenge for him, if he is the nominee, is just to get out in front of those and really establish his reputation before all those attacks come in.
Do you have thoughts, Tina?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, Trump got elected on a policy of attacks and disinformation, a little Russian assist here and there, and really just sort of the politics of hate on something like this. So no matter who the Democratic nominee is, they're going to be called a socialist, they'll be called a communist, they'll be called a whateverist is going to work that day in a tweet when Trump is sitting, you know, in his private tweeting room, wherever that might be, to give us one of those tweets, and on through that. I think that whoever the nominee is going to get put through the ringer. So we shouldn't, to me, we shouldn't even worry about that. We shouldn't even worry about those particular labels. We should know that they are coming. But what's going to stop that whole onslaught, is if we have relationships with the voters that are out there, and you do it on the ground, and you do it via organizing. I think that's the difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. The GOP does not have an on the ground sort of organizing operation where people are talking neighbor to neighbor, block by block, in diverse communities around the country to combat that misinformation. It's not that we need, you know, an alternative to Fox News, because those sorts of things just are more hate. What we need is an alternative to misinformation, and that's a personal relationship with someone. And that's what I believe that the Democratic Party and the Democratic candidate needs to cultivate throughout all aspects of that particular electoral operation, a real, genuine, personal relationships with the voters that are there, and getting them to do one thing, particularly people who don't turn out to vote, but do believe in democratic values and are not happy with what Donald Trump is doing to this country, which is to simply turn in their ballot. They don't always have to agree. They don't always have to feel comfortable. But those low propensity voters, my job as a state party chair is to move them from the risky behavior of not voting to the less risky behavior of voting. And if we can do that, then Donald Trump won't be president and a Democrat will.
So before we get to the general, though, we've got to get through this primary. And Stuart Elway was out here earlier, and he said that he expects that we'll have a contested convention for the Democratic nomination, which would be interesting. Making it more interesting is the fact that we have a couple candidates running for the nomination who are incredibly independently wealthy and not reliant on a support base to sort of keep them in the race. And not only that, but one of those candidates, Michael Bloomberg, has shown a willingness to be combative with the front runner in a way that is that's really quite aggressive in a way that we never saw anybody take on Trump. Mark, you said that, you know, the Democratic Party is going to coalesce around Sanders if he's the candidate. But for right now, like, he is getting hammered, being called a communist, his, you know, past comments about Castro being brought up right now. So if we have a Democratic candidate who remains in the race, even though Sanders remains the front runner, and continues to spend money and continues to attack up until the convention, what is that going to mean for that convention? And are Democrats going to come together?
I do see Democrats coming together, and I think.
But does that mean that what happens to those who are supporting Bloomberg as he is so aggressively attacking Sanders as being somebody who should not represent the party?
Well, I would say that if we're looking at the political reality of today, and especially of the past 2 weeks, there is a candidate that's getting hammered harder than Bernie Sanders, and it's Michael Bloomberg. And I think that we've seen not just results flow in that direction, but all the polling since then has flowed in that direction. And there's really a pushback on the idea of money and power being able to buy control and buy an election. Similar, I think, to what we saw on the ground here in Seattle with Amazon and big money and just people kind of beyond individual issues and just saying, I philosophically disagree with the ability to do that, and this is a wielding of power that is not healthy for anyone. I think that we're seeing the same dynamic with Michael Bloomberg. I think what we're going to end up seeing is if there is a candidate that is running away with delegates, then the talk about, you know, whether we're going to have a contested convention will die down. I think that it's hard to continue to say, to credibly carry a message that I'm the one who can fight and win if your fighting isn't being effective and you're not winning, especially despite the amount of resources that are in the race. So these next couple weeks are going to be pretty illuminating. If they happen to go in that direction, then we're going to continue to hear talk of, you know, who knows what the convention's going to end up doing. But if we see things head heavily into one direction, which is right now what the polling is suggesting, then I think the talk of a brokered convention is going to die down.
But we are in territory that's very unfamiliar to us. I mean, we've never had a candidate like Bloomberg before. I mean, how do we, I mean, that certainly is what we imagine might happen if support falls back from him, that he will withdraw, recognizing that he won't be able to win the nomination. But unlike in the past, that withdrawal of support also results in a withdrawal of the fuel that it takes to run a campaign. So, Tina, what do you think the impact is as this Bloomberg candidacy moves forward? And do you think that he will act as previous candidates have acted if he does indeed lose support and fall out of the running?
Well, I think this presidential cycle is unlike anything we've ever seen before. And I thought 2016 would be the last time I would ever say that. And it's clear 2020 just sort of blows that all out of the water. You know, Michael Bloomberg has been really clear that he will continue to, and all of the candidates have been clear, that they will unify around whoever the nominee is, and they will put their resources in to do that particular piece of work. Now, Michael Bloomberg, Tom Steyer, they have a lot of resources that they could put on the ground, in state parties, in local races, in different campaigns, to work on these kinds of races to make that happen. I'm going to take them at their word that they're going to do that, and they're going to make those investments. I think more so than the things that we might have a difference in terms of how the policy actually gets implemented, but I think when it comes to things like making sure everyone has health care, raising the minimum wage, looking at people who are drowning in student debt, making sure that Social Security is solvent, Democrats all agree on that destination. And so none of us are going to give up on that particular destination in this effort to go against Donald Trump, because all of those things that we hold dear, all of these things that we believe the promise of America should be, well, they will not stand with another 4 years of Donald Trump. So I do think everyone will coalesce around that.
Mark, do you think that Bloomberg will fall in line behind Bernie Sanders?
If not forcefully, at least maybe implicitly. And part of the talk about, you know, the so-called brokered convention, it hinges upon the Democratic Party having these proportional delegate allocation rules. But that in turn, states have thresholds often. In Nevada, you had to get 15% to get anything. And maybe Tina could tell us what
it's nationally. It's nationally, it's 15%. So in the Democratic primary, it's 15% in per congressional district to be able to get any delegates apportioned to you in any state, whether you're doing a primary or a caucus.
Okay. Yeah. So that makes the brokered convention a lot less likely, because it's not hard to imagine a bunch of states where, say, Sanders is 35 and like Warren is 10 and Biden is 12 and Klobuchar is 8. And so you have several candidates who just aren't at 15. Maybe they get over that in particular congressional districts.
Right.
But statewide, they may not actually get many delegates. So Sanders could very easily rack up a ton of delegates with like a 35 to 40% vote if a bunch of other candidates are in like the 8 to 14 range.
And I think that was everyone's strategy too. When you think about a field that was this big, is that if you could potentially keep people out or keep people below that 15% threshold, you could win or take all with some of these states.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly every single presidential candidate has thought about that moving forward.
So, you know, Tina, you had mentioned that it's still so early. There's really very few delegates that have actually been decided, even though we've had a few primaries and caucuses at this point. The media at some point is sort of treating Bernie Sanders as a front runner. He's spoken up as a front runner anyway. But people treat this like it's set in stone sometimes. Are we putting too much stock in these early states that have so few delegates? Can you address that?
I think that we are. Remember, Bernie's got, 46 delegates at this point, I think, out of the 1,991 that he needs?
And we have 87 or something in Washington State, right?
87, and then our total is actually 117 with, full set of delegates on those different places. So it's a long way off in making any of these things happen from a delegate count standpoint to win the nomination. I also think that Super Tuesday tells us a lot because of the big states that are there as the different prizes. California is there, Texas is there, and our primary on March 10th will also tell you a lot too. The two big states or the two delegate-rich states on the March 10th presidential primary are us in Washington State and Michigan. And I think if you look at our electorates, you're going to learn a lot about those electorates as well based on that primary data. So maybe everyone needs to step back for a couple weeks at least and see how this works through.
Does the momentum factor play in the mark at all? I mean, do these early delegates not really matter, or is there more significance than just the delegates themselves potentially?
Well, they matter certainly for the momentum and just the ability to drive the coverage and the narrative, because there's only so many candidates who are going to be actively talked about at any particular point. So I think, for example, in Klobuchar's case, she did better than expected in Iowa, and then she placed a really strong third in New Hampshire, not too far, only 6% behind Sanders and like 3 or 4% behind Buttigieg. And it looked like she might have had a window where she could have come on, but that was right about the time where Bloomberg is getting in and then there's more fire on Sanders. And so she had a couple of days of a lot of attention, but then kind of faded. And Warren has had strong debate performances, but other than that, has had trouble. So in the last couple of weeks, it's been mostly Sanders and Bloomberg are the two who are getting talked about. And as Super Tuesday comes, and then we're the next week, and along with Michigan, and as these move kind of quickly, if you haven't grabbed that momentum in the narrative, it becomes harder to do it just because the whole timetable is shrunken.
Are these just delegates, or do they have a momentum? Are they special delegates?
There's a momentum because there's so few states that start off with voting, and there's so much coverage focused on Iowa and New Hampshire, and so the stories that come out of there are big national stories that are soaking up all of the air. And so you have these stories that are exclusively this candidate won, this candidate lost, what does it mean in this campaign? And voters are soaking up the information of this one is, surging, and this one I thought was strong, but they just lost, and so that's not good. And that definitely matters. And the conversation that a lot of times you hear around the narratives that come out of these early states is those narratives aren't quite complete because those states aren't necessarily representative of the United States as a whole, and certainly not of the Democratic base in a Democratic primary. And in terms of how racially diverse they are, but also when you look in terms of income, I mean, if you look at New Hampshire, the average household income is around $75,000. In Nevada, it's around $50,000. And if you just look at that issue and realizing how important conversations around income inequality are and how that might differently define the issues in the race that are being covered early versus the reality on the ground for most of the voters in the party that don't vote until later, that can certainly color how different candidates are covered and treated. And frankly, I think that's part of the momentum that Bloomberg saw up front, is that, in some of the states where he can just kind of walk in and, buy a lot of the coverage with the early narrative, and they didn't necessarily start off talking about a lot of the issues that he has had challenges with, that as we get into, you look at the South Carolina debate, the Nevada debate, and as we move into those, we're talking about different issues, and voters there are holding candidates accountable in a different way than they are in some of the earliest states. So
So that was actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because Iowa and New Hampshire, not representative of all these other states necessarily. So that some say that that's a problem. You know, that's really is a problem, that maybe we should change it. So each of you, I'm curious, what state do you think should start this whole nomination process, and why?
You know, I'm a fan of having several different states involved, but I think that, you know, this whole who can be first, I think that however that is negotiated, and fortunately I don't have to be the one that is in that process, but that it does need to reflect the reality of Americans on the ground and the Democratic Party and who the party is there to serve. And I think that there is universal agreement that the current structure doesn't do that. And, you know, even getting beyond the conversation of who votes first to how do they vote first, in a conversation that we had here in Washington State. Caucuses exclude people who are working, people who have issues with accessibility, people who need to take care of kids and can't sit in a gymnasium for, 14 hours in a day on a, challenging caucus site. So just looking at who are we including and who are we excluding, and we always do better the more people we include.
So Rhode Island is the answer, right? Then, right? Okay. Mark, what do you think? Which state should lead this off? And would that solve this issue of representation?
Well, obviously, it's Washington that should go first.
Thank you.
That's an easy one. I mean, people have talked about, a rotating primary so that, the thing about Iowa and New Hampshire, it's not like it's one time. It's every 4 years, the same two states going first. So I can imagine some kind of lottery system where, maybe there was like a, you could divide the country into regions, and like you could maybe select one from a particular region, and then it goes to the next region. You're randomly selecting a state from that. That would seem a much fairer system than what we have now. Or maybe you could try to pick a state that most closely resembles the demographics of the country as a whole, which might get you to something like a Wisconsin. You know, there's a reason why it's like a bellwether state. Is because it is pretty close to America as a whole. If you take America and you put it in a blender and you spit it out, you get something reasonably close to a Wisconsin. So that might make sense as a first state.
And I think it's more than just the state that we end up picking. I think we have to take a look at the process. Look, by virtue of being a state party chair, I'm a DNC member, and don't hold that against me in doing it, because many of us have been advocating for change, not just in the debate process, but in the rules process, and in the way that we just conduct this entire process in general, to make it something that's far more accessible in these sorts of things. It's tragic to me that we have seen diversity leave the stage in this presidential process, and different voices leave the stage. It's tragic to me that we've had debates where we have not touched on any of the issues in depth. So this idea of single issue debates where we can talk about climate issues, where we can talk about income inequality, where we can talk about so many things that are facing us in terms of in-depth problems. And you don't just get the, here's my, 5-minute soundbite about issue X, but you could really understand someone's policies or something that we missed.
Yeah, that soundbite that we've heard before at the last 11 debates, right?
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So I want to take just a break and recognize that there are all these beautiful people in the room and that they've been sending us questions. And I'm going to ask each of you a question from the audience. So, Crystal, let's start with you. Would the party unify behind Bloomberg?
I don't know. I think when we talk about foundational issues that we share, that in order for that to happen, I guess I would have to say, there would have to be a meaningful reckoning for stances that he's taken that have frankly contradicted the party platform, and that have contradicted stances that he says he has today. That there's going to have to be a full accounting for how that shift happened and for the impact that previous policies may have had. He was previously a member of a different party. And so we hear issues, and some people bring up with Bernie Sanders, or he's not really a Democrat. Bloomberg has that problem bigger than Bernie Sanders does. And so the conversations that people talk about with can people unify around Bernie are just going to be amplified to a greater degree if it turns out to be Bloomberg. There's going to have to be a lot of work done and a lot of accountability that there has not yet been in order for that to happen. Am I going to say it's absolutely impossible? No. But is it going to be taught hard? Yes, absolutely hard. You know, absolutely it would be hard.
Mark, who is the candidate most likely to beat Trump out of the current field?
I think that's Klobuchar, because she has consistently outperformed other Democrats in a purple state. And if you compare, say, with Warren in a deep blue state, who's consistently ran behind other Democrats. So if you were really just to pick your ideal candidate, someone who could compete in the states that are most likely to be decisive in the Electoral College, it would be Klobuchar. But she just hasn't really kind of stood out. I mean, she's still around, so among the original, 22 to 24, she's in, like the final seven, but it's hard for her to see her breaking through. But I think she would be the strongest in just having the profile that that could unify the party and appeal in the places where the Electoral College will be decided.
Tina, will anti-Semitism impact Sanders' presidential run? In the general?
Not from the Democratic side, but I certainly think
it's the general.
Yeah.
There's a lot of independents out there.
Yeah. I cannot tell you just how low the Trump campaign will go, because I am shocked on a daily basis just how low Trump goes in general. And I wake up the next morning and it's lower, and I wake up the next morning and it's lower, and on it goes. So would I be shocked if that happened? No. Not at all. I would expect no less from the Trump campaign.
And I did not mean to imply that independents are more likely to be anti-Semitic than Democrats. Mm-hmm. Just want to say that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we're going to do a lightning round. We're going to speed things up a little bit. I hope you play along. Mm-hmm. You are all subjects.
I get to be in the lightning round, which is super fun for me. Okay,
so
great.
Melissa is in the lightning round. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read an issue, and you're going to tell me yes or no. Is it going to a winning issue for Democrats in the general? Okay. And I want you to think down ballot as well, not just in the presidential. And then I want you just to give me one succinct, short, wonderful sentence explaining why you believe so. So
I have to go last because I can't do it. You guys got to start. Sorry.
So we've got about 10 issues, away we go. Legalizing marijuana. Tina?
Yes, I think we have a criminal justice system that is unjust, and that will help.
Mark?
I would agree with that, and it's most likely to appeal to the people who are currently not in the system, so that's something to possibly bring in new voters.
Crystal?
Winning issue from the top to the bottom of the ticket, and absolutely it will not only energize the base as popular with independents and some Republicans, and will bring in new voters.
I think you've just seen that. Yes, I agree. I also just get to jump on everything they say, which is great, so I love going last. But you've actually seen the approval of this in many states across the country. I mean, Washington was one of two in 2012, and it's totally shifted where voters are saying yes to this in a lot of states.
That was good. As somebody who has edited you, that was really nice and short.
Come on.
All right. Medicare for all.
I think that health care for all is something that everyone agrees on. Not as Democrats, I don't know that they necessarily agree Medicare for all as the final destination. But I do think that it brings along enough people on health care for all that this conversation about health care is definitely a winner.
Mark?
I think it's a net loser for Democrats. The cost, so many people are uncertain about it. And there's just not enough people trust government to pull off a project like that. So I think it's a net loss.
Crystal?
In the Democratic primary, absolutely a winning issue. We're already seeing that reflected in the vote. Nationally, in a general, it's going to depend on how it's messaged. If after people have been exposed to in-depth messaging, it's a winning issue. Are Democrats going to be able to effectively carry that off? They're still workshopping that.
I think healthcare wins. It's won in swing districts before, especially supporting the Affordable Care Act. When you get to the details of Medicare for All, it pulls worse, is what I've seen. So I just think it's one of those things, people like the idea, get to the details, and support goes down. So I'm not sure how that will play in the general.
So Crystal, you feel like more details actually makes it more appealing?
More detail makes it more appealing. Bringing out that the Republicans aren't really proposing an alternative is different. I think what's going to be really illuminating is an issue like Kim Schreier's race and seeing healthcare matter so much in that race and the conversations had around that. If that can be replicated around the conversation of Medicare for All, then it has a possibility of winning.
She was just public option, though. So you know what I mean? So, I mean, I think that I don't disagree, but I sort of disagree.
It will depend on the messaging. It might not win if they have to message it effectively.
All right. Next issue, free college.
I think are you calling free college or are we also going to talk about college debt? Free college. I think that is a tough one for many folks in thinking about that in a broader sense because of not understanding how people necessarily are going to pay for it. But once folks can understand, okay, if you think about free college and you think about the promise of what we're doing now, like here in Washington State, things like Seattle's promise, all of that, I think it becomes a winning issue to think about how do you move people into different economic opportunities. So I think what I'm saying is complicated issue has to be talked about in terms of college debt as well and getting rid of crushing college debt on folks.
Mark?
I think it's a winning issue from a signaling standpoint. A lot of people are probably skeptical that it would ever happen, but it does signal to young people, we care about your concerns, that's what Sanders is saying, and that even if they're not sure that it's actually going to happen, it still matters in an identity sense.
Mm. It's a winning issue. We're seeing this right now being, you know, it not only passed, but is being implemented in a red state right now, and it's being implemented on, you know, in several states locally, including Washington. I think people underestimate how crushing college debt is to not just younger people, but their parents and families, and how it's really inhibiting people from being upwardly mobile. It's a winning issue.
Yeah, I actually agree on that, and the fact that there's also arguments to be made for how it can affect jobs, economy, and I think you can tie it to that, and that ends up making it not just be like people want free stuff. So, yeah, I think it wins.
All right. Assault weapons ban.
Yeah, I think that's a winning issue. I think that people are done. I think we're absolutely positively done in this country around that, and I think that responsible gun owners are in a very different place. You know what? I grew up in an area of the country where people hunted, and it's like you use an AK-47 on a deer, and there's no deer left to take home. So I think people are absolutely done and fed up, yes.
Mark?
I think any kind of gun control proposal is a net loss for Democrats because amongst the strong gun rights people, they tend to be more single issue voters. Like that would be their bottom line. If you're on the wrong side of that, forget it. Whereas the people who want things like assault weapons bans, yeah, they want that. They want a bunch of other stuff too. So for them, it's just one of many issues. But for the people who oppose it, that's the last stand. And so you alienate more people than you gain from those proposals.
Crystal?
Strongly disagree with that, actually, based on recent polling. I mean, a poll that came out in Washington State in the past week, all of the polling that has been happening over the past 2 years, 3 years actually, going into the 2018 election, it absolutely used to be the case that would motivate the, you know, strong Second Amendment single issue voter base. The difference is independents have completely flipped on that issue, and that opposing that issue now is a liability. That was one of the problems that Republicans had in 2018, and that isn't showing no signs of changing.
In Washington State, and nationally, I'm not as good as these guys are in talking about that stuff, but Washington State, increased gun control has been really popular, and ballot measures have done that, and the politicians have been slower to come on board with it, but ballot measures voted by the citizens, voters seem to support it here at least.
Hmm. All right. So those are the easy ones. Moving the U.S. Embassy from Jerusalem back to Tel Aviv.
Oh, boy.
We saw this come up in the debate the other night.
This is why I'm going last, by the way.
Thank you. I mean, I would Boy, that's such a complicated question. I don't even know how to begin to answer that. I don't even know how to answer that one. I'm sorry. I'm gonna take a prerogative to pass. Yeah.
Okay. Pass.
Yeah.
An Elizabeth Warren there.
Sorry on that one. Yeah.
I think the people who care about that are disproportionately on the right. They're evangelical Christians, and for them, it's a symbolic issue. And when Trump did that, it was, even though he's as far away from being an actual evangelical or a Christian of any kind, it's a signal of identity of I'm with you. And so that helps to consolidate his base, whereas the people who oppose it, they're not out in the streets and making a big deal about it.
You don't think that Bernie Sanders' base feels strongly about the... about the Palestinian cause?
Maybe some of his Twitter base, but amongst the electorate as a whole, I don't think it makes much difference one way or the other.
Yeah, and to be clear, like, he also said that he would take it under consideration. I mean, he's not firm on it.
And that's a little different, I think, in terms of looking at a two-state solution as opposed to moving the embassy. So putting us in that lightning round on the embassy, I think people are less focused in on the embassy piece of it and much more on making sure that there's a two-state solution that works and let's get it done because it's been far too long.
All right, Crystal?
I actually agree with what they said. Speaking of the embassy, that is an issue that has not specifically penetrated on the left as it has on the right to be kind of a, you know, banner issue and very symbolic for the evangelical base. 100% two-state solution is popular and something that I think the entire left can coalesce around, but looking at specifically the embassy, I think that's just going to be tough to really have a meaningful conversation on in the general election.
What did you all think of Warren's answer during the debate? She said it's not really for the U.S. to figure out, just the embassy. Yeah, we did not try and lightning round two-state solution. We thought that was a bad idea.
Right.
Okay, but just the embassy, you know, she said they have to figure out their own capitals, you know, and then, you know, she got a little bit hit on that by Klobuchar, I think, saying, it's our embassy, hey, what? But, I mean, what do you think about that? Is this really something for, I mean, what did you think of that answer?
The whole part of the question, I think, is a little bit of insider baseball, right? Because when you think of embassies and where countries are going to put their embassies, they're going to put them in the capital to begin with. So if we moved our capital if you go to Embassy Row in Washington, D.C., and you see all the different embassies there, granted there are other ones in different cities, but everyone is going to plant their flag, at least one, in Washington, D.C., around that embassy component. If we moved our capital from D.C. to Tulsa, Oklahoma, will all the embassies follow? Sure they will, because that's the seat of the government. So I think that was a little insider baseball answer, maybe.
All right, so we're running a little short on time, so I'm going to skip these more difficult ones, so you've been saved.
Thank you.
Hallelujah.
But I do want to ask you, be as brief and succinct as you can, what is an issue that we have not mentioned that you think the election is really going to turn on?
Income inequality. For me, I think it's all about income inequality and looking at the shift of wealth, what's happened with capitalism, all of these things. There's a reason why Sanders' policies are popular. There's a reason why Warren's wealth tax is popular, all of these different things. If you look at the radical shift of wealth, if you look at this unfair taxation system that's been put in place by Trump, if you look at to see what's happened with our disappearing middle class, if you look at the impact on the working poor, income inequality, I think, is a commanding issue in this cycle and one that's a winner for the Democratic candidate.
Mm-hmm. Popular answer, Mark.
Can I just repeat what
sure.
you said?
Sure, all sure. Right. In the sake of time, we're just going to skip right over you. Crystal?
Absolutely that, but also the Supreme Court, the composition of the Supreme Court and the judiciary.
So, I mean, there have been candidates before that have surprised pundits, observers, media, and to go on and win the nomination. Are there any surprises in store for us this year that you already, you know, use your crystal ball can kind of sort of see coming at this point? I'd love to hear from each of you.
For me, I think we're going to get into a conversation that we're going to be forced into as we head into dealing with the, as the CDC says, the, you know, upcoming coronavirus outbreak that's going to be happening, hopefully not severe, but it seems to be coming, and really talking about how prepared are we actually to handle crises. And I think we might get back to a conversation about how important it is to be knowledgeable and serious about these issues. And I think that we're going to see that rhetoric can't solve a lot of issues that can be deeply impactful to the lives of everyday people. And that might be a conversation that we have to a greater degree than we have in the past 6 years.
Surprises, anyone?
Voter suppression. I mean, I'm deeply concerned about voter suppression in a variety of different states around the country. Here in Washington State, you know, we have the all mail-in ballot, we have automatic voter registration, same-day registration, pre-registration, all of these things that help people to vote, but that's certainly not the case around the country. I worry that people will not be able to cast their ballot, and that will have dramatic impacts on Election Day. I also worry about what happens in terms of, again, outside interference in all of these elections and how that damages America's and America's dependence upon these elections being free and fair in a democracy to have a country that works.
Mm-hmm. Mark, what about you? Surprise?
So what Crystal and Tina said, I would echo those.
But, right. I will take the chance. Passing the buck.
That's chance this time to add one as well, though, which is further development of campaign tactics, some of which could involve things like voter suppression and outside interference and so on, but just targeting of voters and new ways to reach them, especially ways to reach them with outright lies. That if it's only going to a small number of people, how does everybody else even know it's happening, and how do you scrutinize it?
So we are at the end, and I have one more question. Sure. I'm going to bring it back to Washington State. Mm-hmm. I want you all to put on your prognosticator hats and tell us who is going to win the Washington State primary.
I can't do that because I've got a neutrality pledge.
But
that
you're
I've
not,
taken.
It's not who you want to win. It's who do you think is going to win.
I can't say. I'm going to pass the buck on that one.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Mark?
Well, Bernie Sanders was very popular here in 2016. He won it, I think, 72 to 28. Now, in a caucus setup. So a caucus setup very much favors a candidate like him. In 2016, he did better in caucuses, not as well in primaries. So just switching from the primary where it's a broader base, it's going to not pull in as many of his passionate supporters. But even having said that, I still think he comes in as a heavy favorite. So I would say Sanders.
I would say Sanders is coming in as the favorite. I would say, and I would actually impress upon people to say that the primary is a time where you get to vote your conscience. And that just because you see someone might be the favorite walking in. Sometimes in a general, you make some calculations that, hey, I better support this person to keep something worse from happening. But in a primary, you get to make your own decision. And the vote that you make in the primary, even if your candidate doesn't win, can inform the issues
absolutely
in the race mm-hmm. to come. So I would just impress upon everybody that beyond what you hear people predict and it could happen. I'm not going to say that I know for sure that it happens because we all know better than that. But vote your conscience. That's what's really going to make the difference.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Primary this crowded, weird things happen. I'm not predicting anything.
All right.
All of the Crystal's thought is nice. So.
All right. Well, let's give a hand to our panel here, Tina Podlowski.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and Victoria Ralph and produced by Sarah Bernard. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And to learn more about the most recent Crosscut Elway poll, go to crosscut.com/polls. Remember to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back soon with another episode.